Hello, all of you out there in Radio Land. This is KPTZ, Port Townsend, 91.9 FM. And for our virtual listeners, we hope you continue to stay locked on to our website, kptz.org. Our website is more than a way to listen to today's show. For example, you can find the biographies of all our hosts and DJs. You can look up calendar listings to see what's happening around town. You can even sample some earlier shows. In fact, much of the original programming on KPTZ is currently available as a podcast. You know, double your listening pleasure. Listen to today's show as well as some earlier ones. I'm Marianne McNellis. This show is called Our Town. Have you ever wondered who the people are that you see every day around the area? Who were those two women jogging up Morgan Hill in the driving rain? They didn't even look winded. Then there was the group of eight guys exiting Sunrise Coffee down at the Boat Haven the other afternoon. All eight of them were dressed identically in the boatbuilder's uniform of Carhartts and baseball caps. If you ever see a guy in a suit in Port Townsend, you can bet he's either going to a wedding or a funeral. Around here, plaid flannel shirt passes for being dressed up. Jefferson County is full of all sorts of fascinating characters. This show, Our Town, tries to profile some of the singular personalities who live here, but the show is only a half hour long, which is definitely not long enough to do justice to some of our fellow citizens. So consider it a synopsis. We try to get our guests to talk about their lives, their dreams, how they ended up on the western edge of the continent, able to look across the Strait of Juan de Fuca, right at Vancouver Island, Canada. Over time, we'll be talking with firefighters and foodies, bus drivers and baristas, the lawyers and the ladies who lunch. We try to find out what makes them tick and what they think about living in beautiful Jefferson County amid the deer, the otter, and even the magnificent soaring eagles. Today, my guest is Everett Moran, the founder of Rain Shadow Recordings. Welcome to the show, Everett.
Thank you so much. It's an honor to be with you. I'm a true fan.
Thank you very much. Before we get to talking about Rain Shadows Recordings, let's talk a little bit about your background. Are you a local boy, born and bred in Jefferson County?
No, a long way from here in the West Texas desert in the town of Midland, Texas.
Midland, Texas. Mm-hmm. Is that near any big cities?
Well, Midland itself is about probably 100,000.
So that's pretty big.
But it's Amarillo, Lubbock. It's about 100 miles south of Lubbock, Texas, which most people know of.
Yeah, so, most people have heard of it, at least. I don't know if we've all been there. I haven't. Did you go to high school in Midland?
Nope. We moved from Midland when I was 10 years old to Houston. And then I went to a performing arts high school in Houston. Wonderful place, actually.
Why performing arts?
I was into theater and thought I might want to be an actor at some point. I learned in high school as a theater major that I wasn't the greatest actor. So I gravitated towards the technical end of things. I took acting classes and went to theater in Midland, which actually, for a relatively small city, had a wonderful community theater there, one of the best in the country. Huh. And so I did a little acting there, and that's, I guess, where I got the bug. My dad, in his career as a geologist with Shell Oil, and my mother was a journalist. Before they got married, she continued on part-time when we were in Midland for a bit.
Uh-huh.
Yep.
Yeah, I think you told me she worked for Fairchild Publications.
She did, yep. She worked for Baby Talk and Women's Wear Daily.
Interesting. So you went to this performing arts high school. Now, I'm not real familiar with them. I presume you take the regular stuff like algebra and whatever, but what else?
We actually have a longer day, so we would take all the normal academics and then have two periods in our art area.
Do you pick the art area?
Well, you do. I mean, you have to audition to get into school, and this was the High School for Performing and Visual Arts in Houston, and they had an instrumental music department, vocal music, dance, theater, media arts, and visual arts.
So you said you started in theater, right?
Yes.
And did you stay with that?
I played a lot of music while I was there as well, because I was a guitar player. And we moved to Houston. We literally drove from Midland to Houston on my 10th birthday, and the first stop was Goggins Music Store downtown Houston, and my dad bought me a 3/4-size guitar.
Cool.
Yep. And then when we bought a house, the first kid I met in the neighborhood was my age, and he was a guitar prodigy in jazz. So we would ride around the neighborhood and play, and we'd go back to his house, and he'd put on In Session with Herb Ellis and make me trade fours with Herb. So he really developed my playing, really, in jazz. I still have a great love for jazz because of that.
Did you end up in a band?
Well, I did. A young friend of mine who was 13 at the time and a drummer, and I was 15, we started a band together. And I played with it through my 3 years of high school and first 2 years of college. The band actually still exists to this day, some 45, 50 years, however long it's been later, playing a lot of the same songs, as it turns out. No original members.
What's the band's name?
Yeah, the band was called Midstream. Our keyboard player, whose father was a urologist, thought that was a real hoot because Midstream apparently is a section in the urinary tract, which we didn't realize at the time.
I didn't know that. So if someone were to look up Midstream, they could actually find their music, do you think?
Last time I searched for them was a couple of years ago. I mean, it wasn't original. It was a cover band, and we played a lot of weddings and bar mitzvahs and company parties, and we made much more money than we deserved because we weren't very good, but we were playing the hits, and people were willing to pay for that.
And you had fun. Yeah. Sounds like it. Mm-hmm. Where'd you go to college?
University of Texas. I was a lighting design major there.
Picking lighting and design, what was your thought pattern there?
Well, I'd done a lot of that in high school, and they had a very good technical theater program at the University of Texas. And I actually reunited with a friend from high school who was a year older than me, and we were both lighting assistants, which is sort of a prestigious thing in the lighting department there. And we would hang and design a lot of the shows. And because I had experience with sound as well from recording my band and sort of being the guy who took care of the PA, I did a lot of sound design and sound engineering for the theater department as well.
Cool. What about summers? Did you work part-time?
The first summer after my freshman year, I went back to Midland and worked at the community theater there. They had just opened a brand new facility, completely paid for. In fact, had one of the very first computerized lighting consoles in the country. There were only seven in the country at the time. Another one was at University of Texas. So when I got there and saw that console, I thought, this is wonderful. It was extremely advanced for its time.
Sounds like a community that really cared about the arts.
They really did. All the major oil companies had a big presence there because the Permian Basin, where Midland is one of the largest oil fields in the world. You had people that had been transferred from Houston, Dallas, New York that were working for the majors, and they wanted all the accoutrements they'd had in those larger cities. So they had we had a symphony orchestra, great community theater, and they were very supportive.
Interesting. Now, you told me when we were together earlier that your family has something of a history in the oil and gas business.
Yes, we do. And I'm a bit conflicted, but it's what really got us here. My grandfather immigrated from Latvia when he was 17, ended up in Nowata, Oklahoma, where he had an uncle who my great-grandfather had helped come. He ended up moving south to the little tiny town of Maud. No traffic light, anything there. He was working for a dry goods store. 1 week, the owner wasn't able to pay him, so he quit, swore he'd never work for anyone again, borrowed $2,000 from the local bank, and bought a truck that he slept in and started buying and selling scrap and junk. About that time, the oil boom hit. A big discovery well was drilled in Seminole, Oklahoma, nearby. So that sort of evolved into buying and selling pipe fittings and that sort of thing, and then eventually pipe. He bought his first well to salvage the pipe out of it, ended up producing it, and it's still producing to this day. And that was in 1937.
Amazing.
He bought that well.
Well, he sounds like a very determined young man.
He was a really wonderful guy, and he married a wonderful woman from St. Joe, Missouri. My grandmother, who unfortunately I never met, she died about 2.5 years before I was born. My father was very, very interested in science growing up, and he really credits her for that, his love of the astronomy and physics. And he still to this day retains a great love for that. He's a very cerebral man.
And you have a sister.
Yes.
She seems to have inherited some of that. Tell
she
us a
did.
Little bit
She's
about her.
Also very scientifically minded, but also a wonderful musician. She went to University of Texas for a couple of years because she wasn't sure if she wanted to go into science or music. Her violin instructor there encouraged her to go to Juilliard, and so she transferred there and ended up getting a master's in performance at Juilliard and spent her career with the Houston Symphony. She's now retired from the symphony, still teaches, but she has an incredible love for astronomy. In fact, she was a treasurer of the National Astronomical League for a while. Her travel is basically arranged by wherever the next solar eclipse is. She's been all over the world, every year someplace different. Next year will be Chile, the year after that, Antarctica. But she's been everywhere you can imagine, and it's always wherever the next solar eclipse is.
So I guess they know about solar eclipses well in advance.
They can be predicted years in advance.
Well, you can book your trip well in advance.
You could, right.
But you obviously went on something of a different route.
I did. I've always been very impatient. It's probably my biggest downfall. When I was at University of Texas, I spent so much time doing production work. I thought, gee, I really want to try to get on with my career. And so after 2 years there, I left and moved to Los Angeles.
How'd your parents take that?
They were qualitatively supportive. I agreed that I would go out there and give it a year. And if I wasn't making progress in my career after a year, I'd come back and finish school. Mm-hmm. And they were supportive of that idea. And for better or worse, I lucked into a really great job about 3 months into it.
What happened?
Well, I ended up working on the road for Kenny Loggins' band, and it kind of came about a strange way. My grandfather died in August of 79, so I'd been out there about 2 months. I went back to Tulsa to his funeral and met a friend of his who said, well, gee, you're in Los Angeles. You should look up my son. And it turned out that his son, Jerry Levin, was the road manager for Kenny Loggins. When I got back to Los Angeles, I went to Kenny's management office and knocked on the door and asked if Jerry was there, and he was, and introduced myself, told him I'd met his father, and I had just moved out to Los Angeles and was trying to get into the music business. And they had a tour leaving in 7 days and needed somebody.
That's amazing.
So it really is. And so I ended up for about 9 months on the road with Kenny Loggins, basically as a tour intern. Huh. I did a little bit of everything, loaded in the band gear, the lighting, sound. They saw I was willing to work hard, and so they started letting me take on more responsibility.
In the popular culture, there is a certain mythology about being on the road with the band. But what's it really like?
It's a lot like the movie Almost Famous. I mean, yeah. It's definitely dramatized, but it's hard work. But it's great fun. And with a really good band like Kenny Loggins, where he had world-class musicians and the best tech, you never get bored because they're changing it up from night to night because musicians don't want to be bored either. So it's really very enjoyable. You get to see the entire country. I've been to every state except for North and South Dakota, mainly because of my touring with the Kenny Loggins band. That was my first trip to the Pacific Northwest with Kenny. I remember we played Bellingham. He's from Everett, Washington. His brother still lives there as a photographer, so the band photographs for the live album were taken there in Bellingham by his brother. We actually turned 21 in Vancouver. So it was great fun.
When you're on the road with the band, I've seen some of the trucks that they have. Do you live in the trucks?
Well, you live in the buses, pretty much.
Okay.
Often we had hotels, but they were more for showering. Generally, what happens is you're on a tour bus, and I remember the first 2 weeks of that tour, we were flying from place to place in California and Arizona, and the whole band and the crew was talking about, gee, we just can't wait to get to St. Louis and pick up the bus. And I'm thinking a 40-seat Greyhound bus. Had no idea how plush these tour buses were. You know, 12 bunks in the bus, and the stereo, and every bunk, and the stateroom. And so it's really quite posh. It's a great way to travel.
I presume you have bathrooms on the bus.
Yes, there's a bathroom on the bus, absolutely.
What about kitchens?
Yep, there's a small kitchen. Huh? Different buses are appointed differently. I remember one of the Allman Brothers had a bus that was one of those double-length buses with the accordion thing in the middle. The entire front part of the bus was stateroom and living area, and then the back area were the bunks and the stateroom for the stars.
Wow. And I suppose in some of the bigger acts in particular, the stars may have their own bus.
Sometimes it can be that way, you bet, if it's big enough. In our case, with Kenny Loggins' band, we had two buses, one for the band and one for the crew. The crew generally, when the show was over, you're loading everything out, and maybe you're done at 1 in the morning, you're up visiting for a while, go to your bunk and sleep, and you're going to wake up in the parking lot of the next venue.
Well, so, in a way, that's sort of convenient.
It's very convenient,
You don't have to worry about traveling.
Right.
Huh. Interesting. Yep. Now, I suppose since we're talking quite a few years ago when you were first starting out, they would have been all male crews.
Even back then, occasionally you would find a female, but generally they were all male crews back then.
What about now?
It's still overwhelmingly male. There's some wonderful female sound engineers. You see them on the sound side more than anything. And you'll see them on the local union crews when you go to venues. But it's got to be at least 90% male.
Maybe most women aren't into traveling that much. Being on the road that long.
It could be that. And part of it, at least with the local crews, would be just an issue of strength. But there are certainly quite a few women I've dealt with that are a lot stronger than I am. But the fact is, it can be very physical work.
Yeah. Okay, so you were with Kenny Loggins for a while. Mm-hmm. And then what?
Before I started on the road with Kenny, I'd gotten involved with a band called the Bus Boys, which was an all-black rock and roll band from Los Angeles, and they were all about reversing racial stereotypes, and they played what they called minimum wage rock and roll. And they started playing their first shows, local shows, when I was on the road with Kenny. And we got off in the spring for about 2 months before we were due to head out in the summertime, so I started working with them in the interim. Unfortunately, 7 days before we were due to go back out with Kenny in the summer, I was adjusting some lights. I was up on a ladder 30 feet up and leaned out a little too far, and down I came and broke my hip. So I had to be on crutches for the next 3 months and missed the tour with Kenny.
Wow. So what did you do while you were recovering?
The Busboys had been signed to Arista Records, a pretty large deal. In fact, they actually signed the record deal in my hospital room at Cedar Sinai.
That's dramatic.
So they went into the studio to work on their first record. So I was their technical director, so just coordinating gear and the scheduling. It was recorded at Wally Heider, and that came out in, I think, about September of 1980. And then we went on a national tour to support that album.
Wow. Now, at some point, you returned to Texas and went back to school.
Not back to school. I moved back to Austin in 1982. Uh-huh. It was kind of a break in the action. I needed to have surgery on my hip again. I really wanted to live back in Austin, so I moved back there. I thought, gee, I've got a resume. I should be able to work freelance as an engineer. That was completely wrong. There was nobody had a budget for a freelance engineer, because when people book Rain Shadow Recording, or if they book Toolshed Sound, I mean, George Resendez, you're booking the room and the engineer altogether. And that's the way it is outside of Los Angeles, New York, and Nashville. So I really wasn't able to make a living. I'd met someone, was going to get married, wanted to have a family, and realized I needed to make a real living. And no one in my generation was interested in our family oil business. I had some knowledge of it, so I agreed to go up and give that a shot, as long as I had the freedom to work on music projects as they came about. I actually spent 17 years in Oklahoma working with our family business. The last 3 years I was in Oklahoma, I started bringing singer-songwriters to do shows to Oklahoma City.
So when you were working in the family oil business, what did you actually do?
I was basically the company's geologist. Uh-huh. I'm not a degree geologist. When I moved up to Oklahoma, I took some courses at the University of Oklahoma in geology that were germane to what I needed to do for the company, and also went to some workshops in Houston and different places to learn how to read well logs, that sort of thing. But most of what I learned really came from the field, from our production superintendent and the geologists in the area, because you can learn only so much from books. Yeah. Every area is different, has its own idiosyncrasies. That's really where you learn, is out in the field.
Interesting. So you were there 17 years. In the last couple of years, you started dibbling more into the music side of things.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I discovered a wonderful venue called the Blue Door in Oklahoma City. I talk a lot about it at my own shows here, because he was bringing these wonderful songwriters that I hadn't heard from my time in high school in Texas. And he was bringing all these people to Oklahoma City from Austin and Nashville. But he wasn't too interested in the music that was coming out of the East Coast, New York and Boston, that scene. And so I started bringing singer-songwriters from those areas. I did that for about 3 years. Through that, I used a venue, it's called City Arts Center. It was the home for Oklahoma Children's Theater. That's the only time I really got back to lighting design. The director of the Oklahoma Children's Theater saw that I was lighting my shows nicely, so they hired me to be the resident lighting designer for Oklahoma Children's Theater.
That sounds like fun.
It was fun, and I really enjoyed it. Most of the shows were there. We did do some shows at the Downtown Theater. David Burney came and did a production of To Kill a Mockingbird, and so I got to light that, which was a really wonderful experience.
Okay. Mm-hmm. And how did you end up out here?
My wife. I moved to Colorado in 2000. I've always stayed on retainer with our family business, and I took a 50% pay cut to move to Colorado. My first wife and I had split. She wanted to move to Colorado. We had two kids, and she asked if I'd consider moving out there. I said, sure. We'd always talked about it anyway. I found a job at a nonprofit called Swallow Hill, really very similar to Centrum here in Port Townsend, where I was the operations manager and concert director. That got me back into music, and through that experience, I heard a wonderful songwriter named John Davis, brilliant guy from South Georgia. At age 50, he decided he wanted to make a CD and asked if I'd help. And I said, well, I haven't been in a studio in 17 years. And we were rolling tape. This was going to be all digital. But I co-produced a project, and it was the most fun I'd had in 17 years. Stayed really quite busy with recording until I moved up here to Washington. I was doing that and doing a lot of live sound work. Hadn't really dated since my wife and I had split. And then on a weird fluke, I was on my computer and I got a pop-up ad from eHarmony. I thought, just mess around with it. It's a free month trial. And so I filled out the questionnaire. While I was doing this, my now wife, Stephanie, was doing something very similar up in Omak, Washington, in the Okanagan Valley. She contacted me. We just hit it off, and right away via our questionnaires and then email exchanges and then telephone. And we were talking on the phone almost every day. And I said, this is just silly. Let me come up to Seattle.
You're listening to KPTZ Port Townsend 91.9 FM. I'm Marianne McNellis. Dallas. This show is called Our Town. I'm talking with Everett Moran from Rain Shadow Recordings, who's just telling me how love brought him to Port Townsend. Not quite directly, but finish the story. So you met this wonderful woman online.
Right. So we agreed to meet in Seattle. I flew up to Seattle. She drove over. And we spent the first night in Seattle. And then she knew about Port Townsend. And we spent the next two nights in the Discovery Bay cottages. We fell in love with Port Townsend and with each other that weekend. And she's really just a wonderful person. We really only dated about 6 months. We really met online in August. We met in person in October. I asked her to marry me in January, and we got married in May at those same cottages on Discovery Bay. Right.
But originally, she was here in Washington State, and you were in Colorado.
Exactly.
And so did you flip a coin as to where to go?
Well, no. At the time, I was pretty entrenched in Colorado, and she moved down to Evergreen, Colorado, where I was living. Her daughter was in college. Her son still had 2 years of high school left, and so he did his junior year in Evergreen. Stephanie really didn't care for Evergreen. She didn't care for all the snow. We were living at 7,300 feet. She really couldn't have a garden up there, and she missed that. She didn't like Evergreen, and the real kicker was she developed a heart arrhythmia at altitude, so she had to be on a beta blocker. And she asked if I'd consider moving back up to Washington. I said, sure. After a year, we came up and looked at five different communities, including Port Townsend. We came very close to moving to Edmonds because their high school has a wonderful baccalaureate program. But her son knew how much we loved Port Townsend, and it finished a close second in our polling. So we moved to Port Townsend. Turned out to be wonderful for our son, Braxton, who did a senior year here, and he made lifelong friends that 1 year he was here.
How did you end up starting Rain Shadow Recordings?
I've been wanting to build a studio of my own, one that operates the way I want it to work, a large room where I can record everybody together. And those are hard to come by these days. I've been wanting to do that since I was in Colorado. Didn't do it then. Moved up here and really got serious about it. Got the studio designed and originally was going to build at home. We bought a house just south of town on 5 acres. There was room to build a nice large structure there and got as far as having the trees cleared and ready for cement pours. Then certain life circumstances slowed that down, so we're going to have to postpone that for a bit. Then I was working the Blues Festival with Neville, who has had Synergy Sound at the Fort for many, many years. I didn't know about the studio out there, and he mentioned he was getting ready to move a studio home because he was now an empty nester and didn't need all that space. So I went to look at the space, and it was very close to the size of what I was going to build. And I thought, well, this would be great. And I talked to Centrum, who Neville subleased from, and now I do. And they were very happy to know that I was interested in keeping a studio going there. So it was a great opportunity for me, obviously. I love being out there. I think it's much better being out at the Fort than having a studio at home in terms of just the traffic and with the music festivals in the summer.
Right, Yeah. Well, so who are some of the artists you've had there in recent times?
We did John Greyhound Maxwell's last record there. We've had some bands from Seattle, one from Bellingham called Killer Workout. They're sort of almost an 80s retro rock band, but all original music. A band called Jackie. My studio partner, Connor Sisk, who is a Port Townsend native, lived in Seattle for 10 years after high school and moved back here. He's actually starting to bring a lot of pop rock and alternative rock. Another engineer named Gary Mula, well-known in Seattle, has brought over a group called Dumb Thumbs. We did a lot of their EP at the studio. Actually, the first project I did, it was before I'd moved into Neville's space, was a Hot Club Sandwich record, No Pressure. That was actually tracked in the Arcadia House next to the Palindrome. All live, no overdubs. Dave Grisman plays on several cuts on that and co-produced it with Matt Sersley. And then we brought it to the studio, and it was a first project mixed through my console in the studio space.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Now, there are several other recording studios around town that you've mentioned.
Quite a few. Yeah.
How do you see your positioning yourself? What's your special niche?
Well, my business plan is really to be a destination studio. When I was growing up, I knew about the wonderful studio in Colorado, Caribou Ranch, where everybody can imagine recorded, and it was high up in the mountains of the Rockies, and the whole allure of it was this is a world-class studio up in a beautiful place, and bands could come here, and it was like a vacation and recording all rolled into one. And that's what I would really like to do with Rain Shadow Recording. Fort Worden is a perfect place for that, where I could have a band come up from Los Angeles or Denver or wherever. They want to come get away from the city and away from everything to a beautiful place to record. I will offer a block rate that includes lodging and the studio time all rolled into one for week, 2 weeks, a month, whatever it might be. There are some wonderful rooms here. I mean, George Resendez is one of the first people I met when I moved to town. And he has a wonderful place with Tool Shed and very dedicated to the musicians. And I don't really want to compete with what he's doing. He's doing wonderful work. And so I want to try to bring acts here that ordinarily would not have come to Port Townsend to record.
So you are subleasing from Centrum. Do you get involved in their festivals as well?
I usually am doing sound at, you know, Blues in the Clubs and Jazz in the Clubs. The studio has been a venue for Blues in the Clubs. I hope we'll do that again. I guess it's a really wonderful space for it. I try to be cooperative and be as available to Centrum as I can during the summer festivals. I try not to book sessions in the studio so that if they need space to rehearse for their ensembles, it's available for that sort of thing. We've also done a jazz recording workshop in conjunction with the jazz festival, which I plan to bring back this summer. And for that, I bring a friend and colleague from Capitol Studios down in Los Angeles named Steve Jenowick, who has a tremendous experience in making jazz records with Diana Krall and Clayton Hamilton big bands. So he's a really good fit for that.
Wow. That's a lot to take in, really. And you also still continue a little bit with the family business on the side.
I do.
Right?
I commute to Oklahoma most months for a week every month.
That's a commute.
It is a commute. Ironically, being that far from Oklahoma has made it easier for me to get there on a regular schedule because I have to fly it and I have to plan it.
Yeah.
When I lived in Colorado, it was very easy to say, oh, I can go anytime and to put off those trips.
I'll do it in 2 days and somehow 2 days becomes 2 weeks or whatever. Yeah. That makes sense. So now when you come back, what do you think of Port Townsend? Do you think you made the right choice?
Port Townsend is home till I die. We love it here. It's obviously a beautiful place, a wonderful place to be, but it's really the people. The people here are just incredible. We knew we'd move to a wonderful place when the first year we were here, Stephanie went to volunteer at the food bank and was turned away because there was a 2-year waiting list. Now, 11 years later, she's finally volunteering at the food bank. But she's become very involved in beach cleanups and really a crusader for recycling and keeping the area spiffy. So she's always trying to find ways to better the place. This town has the spirit of volunteerism in this town is unlike any place I've ever been.
It's amazing. Yep. It really is. Well, believe it or not, we're out of time.
Well, it's such a pleasure. I really appreciate the opportunity.
I want to thank you for being on the show. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
I also want to thank my engineer and producer, John McPherson. He's the man who will edit our mumbling and grumbling and make us sound so much better than we really are.
Good luck.
I also want to thank three people who are deeply devoted to this station. Larry Stein, program director, Kate Ingram, station manager, and Robert Ambrose, chairman of the board. They all work incredibly hard to make KPTC a strong and vibrant community station. I want to thank you, the listener. KPTZ 91.9 FM is a community radio station. Everyone who works here is a volunteer. And just like Everett was saying, the spirit of volunteerism is part of what makes Port Townsend so special. So if you feel like volunteering, come on down. We really want new people. We like new people. Also, we survive on donations. And you've probably heard that we're about to move from our current world headquarters in a trailer in the parking lot of Mountain View up to Fort Worden, where we're going in a remodeled building. We have contractors. You know what that means. It won't exactly be done on time, and it won't exactly be done for what they quoted us. So keep those donations rolling in, folks. Construction is underway, but we don't know when we're moving, but we will. Okay, listener, I'm Maryam McNellis. I'm signing off for today. The show's Our Town. My guest today has been Everett Moran of Rain Shadow Recordings. Keep on listening to 91.9 FM Port Townsend for more dynamic, eclectic community radio.
Our Town is an original KPTZ production created by Maryam McNellis and engineered by John McPherson.